And until next time, remember, may a bad film be the worst thing to happen to you. Did you guys feel something funny just now?
Was that a rip in the space-time continuum?
I don't know. It just sort of feels like we've sort of slipped through like a black hole or something. And I don't know if I just... Oh, my God! I just looked out the window and it's not New York out there. It's Philadelphia!
That's just wrong.
Yes, we've been away, but we are back now. And, you know, it's a good thing because we have a few questions for the people who made Invasion of the Star Creatures.
So when I look at the poster for this movie, I get totally bewildered. It's called Invasion of the Star Creatures, but there are no star creatures. I see hot chicks in giant test tubes. There are no giant test tubes. Did you guys even see your own movie?
Hey, guys. Do you know what would be funny? No, seriously. Do you know what would be funny?
Weren't Leo Gorcey and Hunts Hall available for the Bowery Boys Meet the Space Vixens?
I understand the need to amortize your expenses by reusing sets as much as possible, but did you really need to get back the $13.95 you spent on your cave set that badly? Those questions and many more may or may not be answered in this episode of Temple of Bad. Welcome to the Temple of Bad, the show where we cover films so awful they're practically a religious experience. I'm Dan Persons.
I'm Andrea Lipinski.
I'm Kevin Lauderdale.
And I'm Arifo Hawk.
And remember, every film we cover on Temple of Bad is available on Netflix Instant View, so you can watch along with us. And we recommend you do, because why waste time on stuff like House of Cards or Daredevil when you can be watching stuff that makes you question the existence of a just and loving God? So, here we are.
We're back.
We're back. Yay! Yay! And boy, it was a long and tortured road to get to this particular show. It was my turn the last time we had done a talking cat. And it was my turn to pick the film. And the film I had picked because I felt, as I had stated then, there was nothing that was going to top A Talking Cat. It was very much... There was one time when I was doing an interview with the director, Mike Lee. And after the interview, I said, well, I could quit right now, because that was sort of like the pinnacle. And A Talking Cat sort of felt like that, too. We could stop there, and we almost practically did. But I picked the Stephen King-directed film Maximum Overdrive, and we were going to do that. Looked promising. And then Netflix pulled it. And then, as I sort of intimated at the beginning of the show, we moved out of New York City to Philadelphia, where I am now decamped. And so that sort of intervened. And when we finally got around to it, and actually we had been talking about this before I made the move, I had sort of settled on Mr. Peabody and Sherman as the film.
A Talking Dog, that was really original. Kind of a laudable movie.
It was completely unconscious on my part. But yeah, it's true. It is a talking dog. So, but we finally came to the conclusion that it wasn't quite bad enough. I actually think in some ways it is bad enough, but it was sort of a cumulative thing. You had to build up to it. And essentially you had to slog through a film that was merely okay to get to the bad part. So we skipped that. And then this came around, and this was actually sort of my fallback thing. I had sort of been toying with this before I had suggested Mr. Peabody, because I had watched a few minutes of it and it looked promising. It's called Invasion of the Star Creatures. And once I watched it all the way through, boy, did it live up to its promise. Oh, boy. So that's the film we are going to be talking about this particular show. And believe it or not, there is a trailer for it. I can't imagine why somebody would actually want to sell this film, but maybe they used it as a warning, actually, to audiences. In any case, let's give a listen to the trailer right now.
Look at those great, big, beautiful babes.
We're here on your Earth as a scientific investigating team.
Hey, baby, you're really out of this world.
As scientists, these girls are way ahead of us. For instance, in the raising of Vegemen, gigantic, man-like robots with fantastic strength. And the things the girls don't know, they're willing to learn.
Let me take you away from all this, my cherie.
Haven't you ever heard of love?
Show me.
The gags and laughs come fast and furious in this fun-filled battle of the sexes.
One of us ought to go back and warn the Colonel.
You don't think he's going to believe the story about galaxy gals and guys growing in flower pots?
If you would, in the interest of science, you understand, kiss an Earthman.
Stand by for a charge, baby.
Okay, so the story is simple enough, deceptively simple, as a matter of fact. A nuclear test in the desert reveals a mysterious cave, and a team of soldiers are sent to investigate. They discover the caves actually conceal a team of alien scientists and their genetically engineered slaves. They're there doing research for an impending invasion. Sounds pretty good, guys, huh?
So far.
To a team?
Wow. On paper,
so far,
great.
And on paper, exactly.
Yeah, yes. Right. It's a comedy, okay? Or it's supposed to be a comedy. And
yeah, we need to discuss that.
Yeah, we shall delve into we may get a little bit sophisticated here as far as delving into the nature of humor. And what's perceived to be humor, but it is supposed to be a comedy. There's the rub. Our protagonists are actually two grunt-level soldiers named Phil Brick and Penn. They're played respectively by Bob Ball and Frankie Ray. It's clear somebody thinks these two guys can be a comedy team. They're wrong. By the way, the film was supposed to star Jonathan Hayes, Seymour Krelboyne, if you remember Little Shop of Horrors. Jonathan Hayes is actually the person who wrote the script for the film. And his co-star was supposed to be Corman mainstay Dick Miller, which is interesting because these guys would usually do anything. So either they both got run over by a truck before shooting started, or I actually like to think that they both said, no, I've got to draw the line somewhere. Even the guy who actually wrote the film said that. So as far as the scientists are concerned, by the way, they're dames, like real va-va-voom types. A rather sparse invasion team. There are only two of them. They're supposed to be 7 feet tall, which is achieved in the film via a complex process of high heels and apple boxes. So Gloria Victor plays Professor Tanga, and Dolores Reed plays Dr. Puna. And you can't tell me that near miss is accidental in that name. So, and by the way, as for the genetically engineered slaves, we're going to need to talk about that at length. We'll get to that in a little bit. Andrea, the film gets a real bad rap, and I'm talking about not even so bad it's good kind of rap. A lot of the reviews are, it's just plain bad. And I have to admit, I'm kind of fascinated by the film. there is the old joke about, you know, like a really bad movie. It wasn't released. It escaped. And I do know the reason this film exists, or I think I understand the reason this film exists. Jonathan Hayes starred in Little Shop of Horrors, as I mentioned, 2 years before, which is famous for being shot in 2 days, although numerous sources contend that wasn't quite the case. But I can imagine that this film was created in sort of the same situation. Sam Arkoff called in the director, Bruno Vasoda, and said, Bruni, I imagine his nickname is Bruni. In any case, he says, Bruni, we need another film to fill out the bottom half of the bill. You've got 2 days to do it and call it Invasion of the Star Creatures. And thus, this film got made. By the way, this film was released in 1962, you know what else happened in 1962, guys? Anybody?
No, tell us.
Were we actually invaded by star creatures?
No, but there was the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm not saying there's a connection, but think about it for a while. thing for me is that one of the things that sort of fascinates me about this is that this is a film that really doesn't get made anymore. This sort of, well, we've got to put something up on the screen and we've got $1.95 to do it, so let's just plow through it and film whatever's going to fill that time. And you know, we're going to get to the upshot of that, but watching it, I kept thinking, like, who did they really make this film for? And I think the answer is they pretty much made this film for themselves, to, you know, whatever they thought was going to be amusing and get them through the process of getting something up on the screen. What was your reaction to it, Andrea?
Well, I mean, my reaction was when I started reading it, I'm like, okay, this, I mean, when I started watching the movie, it's like, okay, this seems like a low budget film. And then within the first couple of seconds, I'm like, wait, the opening music is an electric drill? Like, what is,
I thought it was a vacuum cleaner.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, look, I enjoy low-budget things. I get a kick out of low-budget things. As soon as they said, and there's something going on in a mysterious cave, I said, oh, let it be Bronson Canyon. Let it be Bronson Canyon. And then I saw the cave, and I'm like, yay, that's where Roman lives. To be like the human. To think like the human. And then the more I watch the movie, I'm like, I wish Roman would show up. A gorilla with a fishbowl on his head would kind of liven things up, and maybe he would kill these characters, and I would start to feel better. You know, I mean, it worked for me on one level, just as a, I mean, to be fair, I laughed at this movie more than I laughed at Mr. Peabody and Sherman. So there was that. I mean, it's definitely not one of my favorite bad movies. It was more a, I'm laughing because I'm shaking my head because it's so bad. And we're not even, that was even before the giant race card was played. And then it dropped to a whole different level. And it scraped an even lower level of the bottom of the barrel that I didn't know existed until that moment.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I don't want to get into detail of it because, you know, like the film, we should save the best for last. But it's true that it just sort of chugs along and it's just sort of fascinating, and then, like, at about, you know, with 20 minutes left to go, all of a sudden it takes the big, deep dive.
Yeah. I mean, my main pieces of advice are, if you're going to be watching this movie and you read the description of the movie or you hear our description of the movie, I'll just warn you, every time the words comedy or comedic are used in conjunction with this movie, you should mentally put those words in quotation marks. Kevin. And I think they got these actors because Jerry Lewis and the Ritz brothers were busy. Yeah.
Kevin, how about you?
I liked it a lot more than I thought I was going to like it. I can see where on paper this could have looked promising. Because, okay, earlier they'd done a horror comedy. Now we're going to do a sort of science fiction comedy. There's going to be some space jokes. We're going to put cute girls in there. It's going to be kind of like maybe a road picture with Hope and Crosby, only much lower budget. I mean, make no mistake, this is a bad movie. But comedically, some of the things work structurally. They just don't work when you're actually supposed to laugh. And, of course, cheapness of sets, cheapness of costumes. And you often wonder when you're doing something like this, is any of it intentional? Like, those alien monsters look like tiki men wearing corn bags on their heads. Yeah, Is that intentional? Should we go for the laugh? I keep thinking of Roger Ebert, who said, be afraid of any comedy that has a character with a funny name or a guy who drives a funny car, because that means they didn't have the confidence to just let the characters be funny. So when I see something weird, I wonder, is it weird or is it funny? Quotation marks. Yeah. Thanks, Anthony.
You could also throw in there, beware of any comedy that uses undercranked camera way too much, which is what they do here. But by the way, for those not up on the technical term, undercranked camera is essentially fast motion. So, Hawk. Oh, sorry, Andrea, did you want to throw something?
No, I was just going to say, undercranking the camera, think of Benny Hill.
Yeah, exactly.
Chasing people around or being chased around.
Exactly the point. Hawk, how did it sit with you?
I pretty much, from the get-go, was going, oh my God, I'm in trouble. Because the first thing I see is R.I.Diculous Presents. And then I'm like, no, no. Then the credits start, and there's humor in the credits sporadically, like the first female lead, next to her name is Wow, and then next to the other female lead, it's Wow Wow. So it's like, look, there are babes in the movie. Babes, look, we're pointing them out. Babes. And that's the entirety of it. Kept pointing at itself, going, look, it's a joke. It's a joke. It's a joke here. I just made a joke. Laugh. It's a joke. And if you have to tell me it's a joke, if you have to try that hard, it's not a joke.
I want to talk about those opening credits for a bit, because that's really fascinating. I mean, like Hawk pointed out, there are actually two credits in there for two of the actresses, and the credits actually say Gloria Victor, Wow, the word Wow is actually printed on the screen, and Dolores Reed, Wow, Wow. And, you know, it's not that I'm surprised that this seems to be the first time that I've seen credits that actually editorialize during the credits. I just find it unusual that we haven't seen this actually in other films. You know, it's like, you know, it would make the film a little more fascinating. You know, it's like cinematography by Robert Yeoman. Fuck that guy. You know, or screenplay by Lawrence Kasdan. Son of a bitch owes me $20.
Now you realize you set that idea out into the ether, it's going to get picked up. I do have to say, aside from the credits, you know, the credits go right into that opening joke with the hose, which might be the worst physical comedy I've ever seen in my entire life. Because it's supposed to be funny, this whole thing where he's lost control of the hose, but I've been in my yard with a hose that's more powerful than the one he was using. And yet, he couldn't control it. He's bouncing all over the place. And then when he finished, he's vibrating. My power washer hasn't left me vibrating like that.
Maybe you haven't been using it in the right place, Hawk.
Yeah, Hawk, clearly you don't understand comedy. If you don't understand the hilarity of that.
Well, let's talk about the leads here, Philbrick and Penn, the protagonist.
Poor man, Bugs and Daffy.
Two of the biggest morons to walk the earth?
Well, here's what's weird is that actually you say Bugs and Daffy. Actually, it starts off more like the poor man's Mo and Curly. It's very clear that they're trying to do two-thirds of the Three Stooges at the beginning of the film. And then after that scene, and we can talk about this a little more a little later because it sort of plays out through the rest of the film. After that scene, they sort of drop that. But, I do have to say one thing about them. The guy who's playing Philbrick, Robert Ball, if you watch closely, he's actually very agile. He actually does a number of his own stunts in the film. And, you know, one of the hilarious bits in that opening sequence is him going butt first into a giant steel bin. But he actually does it.
When he's doubled up, was that actually his body or was that just some fake legs?
My thought was that it was fake legs, but now I'm wondering if it was actually him. Because
I can't believe you're trying to find redeeming features.
It's the high point of the film.
You know, Dan, when you mentioned two-thirds of the Three Stooges, I wasn't thinking Moe and Curly. I was thinking that Philbrick was the love child of Larry and Curly. Because his mannerisms and his voice are like some sort of weird blend of Larry and Curly. And I just sat there and went, did Larry and Curly have a love child?
I'm sorry. Now, I know that I am not a Three Stooges, aficionado here. But I know that there's something like sounding like Curly. But in comparison, you have to go to least funny members of groups. So was he like the Shemp or was he the Zeppo?
I think what you're thinking of is Curly Joe.
Joe.
Yes. You know, I never. You might be right about him being a hawk. You might be right about him being a cross between Curly and Larry. But frankly, I don't think there's ever any point in the film where he goes, "Hey, leave him alone."
I have to say, I kept wanting to laugh. I did. I tried. I looked very hard for opportunities to laugh because it's a comedy. And I wanted to be able to say that, well, at least that was funny. And I left empty. Here's the funny thing. I said this before. I believe Talking Cat is the worst film that I have ever seen. Given that, they were at least trying to be redeeming and uplifting and happy in some way, shape, or form. It was a bad movie. Mm-hmm. But there was some sort of redeeming quality on the back end. There, I left and was like, it's like eating cotton candy, except without the sugary goodness flavor. I put it in my mouth and it just melted. Well, did I eat something? I could have sworn. It's like ice on your tongue.
There's no there there.
Yeah, absolutely. None. It's just, I turned it off, and then I said, under ordinary circumstances, like with a talking cat, where I wanted to actually strangle Kevin, because it was his idea. And then left me. Dan and I just have to have a mild discussion about this. and that discussion is with me. What were you thinking?
Well, unlike a talking cat, the person who wrote this at least knows a little something about story structure and comedic structure. In this film, there's repetition of ideas. There's escalation of ideas. There's one-liners that make sense in the context. So,
we're, yeah, okay, a, yeah, you got to give him that.
"It's better than a talking cat," says Temple of Bad.
One hell of a poster. In one of many examples of damning with faint praise.
The faintest.
By the way, in this scene, we also meet the sergeant.
Sergeant Glory.
Sergeant Glory. Does anybody know which actor that is? Because I looked up on IMDb, and IMDb is being very very cagey about assigning character names to any of the other actors.
Yes, it was very curious, right? Because I wanted to look up that AWOL guy. Because I'm like, I think I've seen him in something else terrible before. But he's not listed. His character isn't listed. There are a bunch of actors listed, so I suppose I could just go through every single person. But yeah, it just lists like five people. And then everyone else are like, these people played someone.
Sergeant Glory and Colonel AWOL.
Yes.
Remember what you said about funny names?
Hilarious!
And Sergeant Glory, well, you know, like, he's a hip cat, man. He keeps talking like he's hip to the jive. And
he's cool! He's cool!
He's cool, daddy-o!
I dig it, man.
I'm like, oh my god! And then Colonel AWOL is every incompetent officer in charge of an army base that we have ever seen, except not funny.
I'm looking at a website called 1000 Misspent Hours, and their entry on Invasion of the Star Creatures uses terms like probably. The sergeant is probably Slick Slavin of Bride of the Beast and Atomic Kid. And Colonel Thomas AWOL, it says Mark Ferris. They at least have the.
I've got, interestingly, IMDb lists him as Colonel Rank, but it is Colonel AWOL. Then again, they may have called him Colonel Rank at some point.
I wanted to check that, actually, because Colonel Rank was the guy who showed up at the very, very, very end.
Oh, okay.
Because that's what I was looking at, because I said, wait a minute, let's look up this guy, Mark Ferris. Well, whoever Mark Ferris is, he has one acting credit, and this is it.
Is it. And you don't even get to see his whole face.
Yes. There's that.
Partially obscured by a mammoth mustache. It's interesting because this is 62. We are like after Korea, but before like Vietnam really started to become an issue.
And okay, so we're between wars. I needed to fix this in my mind.
And on top of that, we're still 2 years away from Dr. Strangelove, which. In some ways, sort of rewrote the way we looked at the military. And look at the way the military is being portrayed here. You know, it's like you've got, for one thing, you've got the Hepcat, you got the Hepcat sergeant and the sort of the warmonger colonel. But he's a warmonger, but he's also rather silly and ineffectual. You know, and the thing that Dr. Strangelove sort of changed was that it could be funny, but it could also be very, very scary.
Okay, Dan, I don't care that both of these films are about war. You should not be allowed to mention this film in the same breath as, you just can't.
You just put Kubrick in the same breath as Ridiculous Product Presents. Just think about that. You went Kubrick, Ridiculous. Kubrick, Ridiculous. No!
It should not exist in the same universe.
Okay, I'll back off.
Oh, you beat me too. I was about to actually make a comparison to this film in 2001 with regards to artistic integrity. because one of the neat things for me was the fact that when the aliens are talking amongst themselves, they're not talking with accented English. They're using like a purely alien language. So I was going to say that's not quite the equivalent of the silence of spaceflight in 2001, but it shows somebody's using a little bit of thought. There's another poster quote for you. This film uses a little bit of thought.
Kevin, you want to compare this film in the same breath as 2001? I mean, I don't think you should do that, Kevin.
Sorry, Andrea. I have to do that.
I wanted to ask you if anybody noticed this. The scene that follows that opening scene is the scene with the colonel where he essentially lays out that they did a nuclear test, they discovered this cave, and he has, you know, basically the full complement of the base that he's talking to there, which means he has all five men there. But one of the things that he does is he has a grenade on the desk. And by the way, they do a close-up of the grenade, and it's very clearly a dummy grenade. You know, it's very clearly just a lump of lead that somebody mocked up. But he takes the grenade and he throws it over their heads. Now, the way the scene is shot, it's very clear that they've only got two walls to the set. You know, they got two walls, they come together, they form a corner. And the way it's shot, you presume that there's a line of men that the colonel is talking to. And you can presume that there is maybe a wall behind those men where the camera actually is, but there's supposed to be a wall maybe, you know, 3 or 4 feet away. He takes that grenade and he lobs it like he's standing at one end of a football field.
I can't believe the things that you pick on, man. Look, how about the fact that a grenade goes off, and how do we know the grenade goes off? The camera shakes and nothing else. They couldn't even afford some stagehands to throw some debris from off camera to pretend there had been an explosion?
No dry ice? No smoke?
I don't think they could afford dry ice, Hawk.
I suspect a lot of what Mark Ferris did in that scene, he ad-libbed during scene.
I don't know if that makes things better or worse. Look, let's not also forget that in the very, very opening narration, they talk about the base, and then I could have sworn they said something along the lines of all of the men that work here on this base were handpicked. I'm like, for what?
if that's the case, then the Cold War was essentially, detente was maintained in the Cold War by accident. Because, oh my God, it's like, if Russia chose to invade at that point, well, we had, the Larry Curly hybrid and, a colonel who threw a grenade, in a crowded room defending us. Yeah, that's going to work.
Go ahead, Andrea. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, we have spent so much time talking about the men. Still have not addressed the women, still have not addressed the vegetable monsters.
We're getting to that. I just wanted to throw in one more thing about that scene, is that the colonel in his speech explains that, and I think he says it's something like 2 weeks ago, they did a nuclear test, which means that all of the men in that room arrived to that base less than 2 weeks ago. Because you would think if they did a nuclear test near a base,
they would know that.
They would know that.
Or they'd all be dead from radiation poisoning.
Exposition is not for the characters in the movie. Exposition is for us.
So let's move on. The men get the assignment to go and check out this cave. Yes, we go to Bronson Canyon. And yay. Like Andrea, I said, wow, where's Roman?
Yay.
Yeah, does not show up. But they basically, Penn and Philbrick are left outside. And then the Sergeant Glory, and I think it's three other men, two of whom are actually quite handsome-looking, by the way, not that we get to see them much, go into the cave, and this is where we get our introduction to the cave set.
Oh, boy. Well, hope you like the cave set, because you're going to be seeing it a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope you like the bit they do with the cave set, because you're going to be seeing that a lot, too. Basically, what it is a mocked-up cave, and they've got sort of like a switchback ramp that zigzags down. It's, you know, it's mocked up like rock and all of that. And they do what is essentially a variation of the, you know, the bit where there's a chase scene in a comedy film and you've got like a hallway with a line of doors along both sides of the wall. And, you know, a character will run into one door and then run out another door. So they do that with, and first they do that with the soldiers, but we'll be coming back to that cave a lot. I was sort of fascinated by the idea of how they actually shot the thing. I would like to think that, you know, they had sort of this set that they spent $1.95 built, and it was over in one corner of the studio, and they'd get the actors, you know, that they needed for whatever scenes they were going to shoot that day. And like during the last hour of the day, they take those actors over to the set and go, okay, now you walk down this ramp this way, and now you walk up that way. And then they recut it in different ways to make it look funny. Except it's never funny, is it?
If you've seen an episode of Scooby-Doo, you've seen this joke.
If you've seen it in Scooby-Doo, you've seen it in, you know, the Beatles in Yellow Submarine, when people kind of run in and out of different things. And it kind of happens once, and you go, oh, ha, 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 all right. And then, like, 17 times later, you're like, oh, my God, I don't believe they're doing it again.
I really wanted to grab that and overlay Yakety Sax.
There are lots of parallels to Benny Hill here.
Yes.
In that nobody finds Benny Hill funny either. By the way, at this point, this is when the soldiers investigating the cave encounter the Vegemen, the monsters of this film. And we cut to the outside and we hear gunshots. Did anybody think the soldiers were actually killed at that point?
No.
No?
No, not really, no.
No. Because I thought, well, this has taken a grim turn for comedy.
No, given the nature of this movie, I definitely didn't think they were killed. All I thought was, well, we probably won't see them again. That was what I was thinking. Just like they'll mention them briefly that something happened to them or something or other, and then we'll never see them again because, well, they couldn't afford to bring them back.
Yeah, God,
for another day.
If people weren't killed by a gun going off in an office and a grenade going off in an office, and if everyone hadn't died of radiation poisoning from something having gone off a short distance away, no one was going to die in this movie.
So we're back outside now, in any case, with Penn and Philbrick. They're having a picnic. Again, this is supposed to be funny, I guess. It isn't.
You mean, come on, all of those comedic elements, they packed wine and wine glasses and candle holders? Hilarious!
And he left the radio back in the base!
Exactly something Daffy Duck would have done.
I don't know why Penn didn't say, you knucklehead at that point, but... This is the point, by the way, where they get captured, okay? They get taken into the cave. They get taken into the alien encampment. We finally meet Tanga and Puna.
Dr. Puna
and Professor Tanga.
Props for feminism, 1960s
That's
feminism.
True. That's true.
Ouch.
Dr. Puna is obviously doing a postdoc.
For about 5 minutes.
That's true. And by the way, is it ever established that it's an all-female race? By the way, I don't think they do that, although there's sort of an implication there, isn't there?
They say the women, the veggie men do the work. The women are the technologists and some. Anybody remember? There is some sort of division, but I don't remember if they actually mentioned if there are males.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, look, everything is a microcosm of something else. Everything represents a much larger population. All right. Based on the human Earth men we meet, all Earth men must be morons. Based on the lady scientist and professor we meet, the ladies on this planet must be very attractive, bad at acting, bad at emoting, bad at walking. That was pretty impressive. Based on the vegetable monsters we meet, the vegetable monsters are hilariously low budget and entertaining. They are ridiculous. Also, is it just me? Did they only have two vegetable costumes?
Yep.
Because I don't think we ever saw more than two of them at a time.
There's never more than two Vegemen. There's never more than two alien women, and there are never more than I think the total complement of soldiers is five or six, if you count the colonel. Yeah.
There's never more than two complete Vegemen, but we see feet and hands.
That
growing in the garden.
Growing in the garden. By the way, did anybody flash back to the – when you saw like the hand in the pot, did anybody flash back to the Man Trap episode of Star Trek where they did essentially the same gag with a plant?
Oh, Beauregard?
Yes, Beauregard.
Plant. Man. No, but I flashed back to Little Shop of Horrors produced by the same company a couple years ago. Like, oh, it worked once. We can work it again.
Speaking of how low the budget was because we only saw two Vegemen, I have to point out two instances where the very small budget really, really caught my eye. And one of them is in the scene where Fildrick and Penn get captured, and they're placed behind a force field. Now, initially, it's a piece of plastic, so they can bump up against it, and you can see their noses bend and their faces distort. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it's them miming being behind the field. Just miming. I'm like, you had the plastic before. Why did you not use it again in that scene? And then I realized it may not have been a big enough sheet to actually be in the next shot. So, but they're sitting there and they're just miming being behind the field. But the worst thing about it is it's really bad miming because they're not lined up. They're not lined up at all. They're not synced or lined up. So basically, one is pushing out further than the other. And I'm like, well, that's a funny look. That's a funny kind of force field. It was flat at one moment, and now it's got divots. And so that's one. But one of my favorite bits is when Penn decides he's going to use telepathy to talk to the Vegemen and overpower their minds with his. And he's concentrating, and he's supposed to be sweating. And it is incredibly obvious that there is someone standing out of shot just pouring water on his head. Because the sweat is not coming from his brow. It is coming from over his hair.
But to be fair, that is one of the few scenes where I did laugh. Okay. But look, I had a couple of theories. Yes, the not a big enough piece of plastic is one theory. I had an idea that maybe they didn't use the plastic again because it was a larger shot, and so it might have like reflected, you know, the camera might have reflected on the plastic and caught the light. Or, hey, maybe the two morons wanted to show off their Shields and Yarnell mime styling skills.
Deep cut. That's going way back.
Well, this is the scene where definitely Frankie Ray, who plays Penn, wanted to show off his ability at impressions.
Oh, he had been doing that for the entire movie. They're all bad. They're just all awful. It's like, well, there's a James Cagney. I think there's an Edward G. Robinson. Why does Cagney sound a lot like Robinson?
Well, this is the first time with the exception of him doing Mo at the beginning of the film, this is the first time he pulls it out and he's doing Bela Lugosi in this particular case. And yes, he does Cagney at one point. He does Edward G. Robertson. He does Peter Lorre. Apparently, he spent a lot of time hanging out at the Warner Brothers backlot for some reason. I just sort of get the feeling that at some point he said, this is the only way I'm going to get through this scene alive.
Well, look, just like I said before, it, you know, anytime that we see you know, comedy or comedic, put that in quotes, anytime someone is, like, acting like someone, just substitute a poor man's whatever. So he's doing a poor man's impression of Bela Lugosi. I watched this film twice.
Hold on, Andrea. I'm sorry. Yes. I can't interrupt. But yep. That's an insult to people doing poor man's impressions.
An impoverished man's, a bottom of the barrel, absolutely, you know, no money thing. Look, I watched this movie twice. I watched it once by myself, and then I made my boyfriend watch it because he enjoys the Three Stooges and he enjoys the Bowery Boys. So I said, okay, let me watch this with him and then let me watch his reaction to it. And he did not laugh. He sat there watching it, shaking his head or periodically saying, oh no. And that was usually when they were going to be going back and forth doing that Scooby-Doo thing again. So I asked him later, I'm like, okay, but how was this worse than that other stuff? Because you like that other stuff, and that's stupid. And he said, yeah, but this was trying to be that. This was trying to be the Bowery Boys, but failing.
By the way, should we talk about another running gag through this film, which is Commander Connors?
I love Commander Connors.
Go on,
yes,
Kevin.
This is my favorite part. This is where comedy works. So apparently within the universe of this film, there's a TV show, a radio show called Space Commander Connors. I mean, actually, it's like Tom Corbett Space Cadet or something like that. And some of our – who is it? The junior one.
Phil Brick.
Has a Space Commander Connors ring, and he keeps bumping into other people who also have them. And the beauty of it is, it's a fan club, and he has a certain rank. And so, is it the colonel actually is also a member, but he has a lower rank, and eventually we'll meet somebody who has an even higher rank. So, comedically, this is beautifully structured. It's very meta to have a science fiction universe within a science fiction movie. And it builds. First, you think it's just a throwaway joke, but then somebody has it. And then, rule of three, somebody else has it, and it's even higher. I mean, if I was writing this movie, I would have put that in. I was charmed and surprised by it. I love that element.
Wow. For this movie, that is high praise.
Yes, indeed. So in any case, yeah, they escape from imprisonment. They are able, yeah, Phil Brick is able to pull rank on the colonel and recruit him. Now, you know, later on in the film, we see stock footage of like whole ranks of soldiers, you know, like marching and everything. They go to the colonel and they say to him, you know, aliens are about to invade. Does the colonel think to, well, we've got all these soldiers here. Maybe we should array some of them and attack the cave. No. He puts on his Commander Connors space helmet and follows Phil Brick and Penn. So it's the three of them going, because apparently it's a stealth mission.
By the way, he didn't believe them about the invasion until the Commander's Connors ring, secret decoder ring, was shown to him. Then all of a sudden, that changed his mind. So what we've learned about Colonel AWOL is that he's mentally 10.
Okay, so they're out on the road now. They are going to the cave, and here is the moment we've all been waiting for.
Who do they meet, Dan?
They meet the Indians.
Oh, boy.
Oh, God, the Indians.
Just to clarify, they don't meet Native Americans.
No.
They meet Indians. Indians.
And how?
Out.
Keep big racism coming.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God.
Hang on, I might need to drink some fire water to keep having this conversation.
But by the way, you know, I congratulate them for the tremendous restraint they showed in not using the term fire water.
I kept waiting for it.
You know, because everything else is there. You know, yeah, yes, smoke 'em peace pipe. Yes, drink 'em fire water.
Speaking in the broken English, the getting drunk.
Oh yeah.
The peace pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the dancing and the yelling.
What?
Oh,
what
the dancing?
What the hell was that dancing anyway? Because, you know, it's like when the Indian is the higher ranking Commander Connor guy, and when he finds it out, he starts to do what I guess is supposed to be a war dance, except it doesn't look like a war. It's like he said to the director, "Well, I can't war dance, but I can river dance,
or I can dance like I have ants in my pants."
My underwear is too tight. Let me dance.
By the way, do you think he was actually an Indian? Oh, hell no. Several
of the backup Indians who were with him looked like actual people of the actual Native American persuasion.
Yeah.
That guy, though, I think might have been Indian, but might have been Italian,
yeah,
or might have been anything. He might have just been a guy with a tan.
The bottom line is generally in these movies, in these kinds of movies, historically, it was if you were of Italian extraction or a Spanish extraction, and you were dark enough, it was like, hey, you could be Indian. Which, by the way, is still a thing that happens because, well, all the brown people look alike. So there is, I mean, this is the thing that still happens. I was reading an article today in crack.com about this actor who's of Maori descent from New Zealand, and he's played everything except someone from New Zealand. So, happens.
To be fair, I just found out this year that the crying Indian, the guy who was looking at the garbage and crying, you see the tear running down his face, that was an Italian guy. But he billed himself as an Indian.
Yeah. And while we're talking about that, there is an uncredited actor in the film named Mike Del Piano. And I'm just suspecting that's him. And I am also suspecting that the reason he was cast is that either because he was the guy who actually owned a horse, or he was the guy who brought the crew their reefer every day.
Oh, my God.
Oh. Yes, and speaking of the horse, yes, the Indians are all traveling together, except only one is mounted.
Well,
maybe they were making a short trip. They were low on fire water, they had to go, on weed, or whatever was in the peace pipe.
No, because he's the one dude who had a horse. That's probably the way he managed to keep a job in the film industry in Hollywood, because you hired him. You also got the horse as well.
You know what? I actually just saw a movie. I mean, actually like a good film noir movie from the 1950s recently, and I was looking up stuff on IMDb, and one of the weird trivia facts was extras were paid this much or this much if they could also supply a car.
Yeah.
So maybe the guy got a better rate because he brought his own horse.
Yep.
Have horse, will travel.
So these guys they play out all the Indian cliches, but I wonder if there's something to be said for the fact that the Indian – pardon me, there goes my kitchen. And the walls came tumbling down. We can edit that out, fix this in post. Something to be said for the fact that the Indian is the highest ranking member of the Commander Connor space squad.
I suspect that the joke – in that case, is that the savage is in charge. I suspect that that's the actual joke.
Number one, it's a joke. Number two, it's like adding insult to injury, because, I mean, I see the whole movie and the whole thing about the Indians is just insulting, and you see how they're trying to be funny, but it's not. And then when it's all done, I'm like, wait a minute. The Indians did nothing.
Well, here's the thing about that. I don't know. What little I could find about the film is that there are actually two versions of the film. There's a 70-minute theatrical version, and then there's an 80-minute TV version, which is the version that's on Netflix. And I suspect that one of the things that helped pump up the time was this sequence, because, Andrea, you're right. Yes, the sequence goes absolutely nowhere.
So they added in the Indians?
That's what I was trying to figure out as well, because if that was true, I was looking for a continuity error that would show where the film picked up or where they had edited in that extended sequence, except that when they leave the Indians, Philbrick has the fire water jug, and in the next scene where they enter the cave, he still has the jug.
There can't be that much of continuity errors because everybody only has one costume.
Look, you could easily trim 10 minutes off of this movie. Just cut out most of that dancing. Oh, look, he's dancing again. Or cut out the people running back and forth in the Scooby-Doo maneuver. Come on. That's easily 10 minutes.
That's half the movie. Gone. Right there.
Yeah. So in any case, they get back to the cave. I'm trying to figure out how exactly they stop the invasion. There's something where they put the spaceship, the spaceship takes off and they put it in stasis or something.
You skipped the part where Philbrick kisses his one of the space babes and short circuits her brain because they know nothing. Because, of course, the alien women know nothing of love.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. That was earlier in the film. That's good. That's going to lead into this. He kisses Puna.
What is kiss?
Which means she's going to get kissed.
Hey, if that worked for James T. Kirk, it works for this moron too.
I think we forgot to mention the fundamental conflict of the film somewhere along the path here.
I'm sorry, there's a fundamental conflict of the film.
So the aliens are here because, as Dan just alluded, they want to somehow invade. But what are the girls do? Are they like an expeditionary force?
They've been here for years.
They've been there in the cave with the veggie monsters doing whatever the hell the veggie monsters have been doing. And their ship was damaged when they landed, so they've been trying to fix their ship. What the morons do is smooch a chick which short circuits her brain, and later the morons push a lot of buttons which all make hilarious sound effects, and one of those things that they push accidentally launches the ship, and so the ship launches without the hot chicks on it, and thus the hot chicks are there and marooned.
That's what happens. Okay,
and that's how we win, and I'm putting win in quotes.
Because if the alien's home planet doesn't hear from them, they're going to assume that they were captured and the planet is too strong for them to invade. Mind you, they've been on the planet for a decade. They don't already know this?
Maybe they didn't pack their radio either.
By the way, don't knock those sound effects. That's one of the few times I laughed. I'm a sucker for funny sound effects.
Oh, a frog, a foghorn. Yes. Yes.
They always have to have the foghorn, don't they?
Yes. I'm laughing now.
See?
By the way, this leads to my favorite line the film because,
let's hear it.
They've marooned the aliens. Now, Puna talks Professor Tanga into kissing Penn, and so now she's smitten, and the two guys start talking about marriage, and I think it's Puna who says, "What is marriage?" And Philbrick says, "That's when a boy and girl get hitched. She belongs to nobody but him." And Dr. Tanga says, "Like slaves?" And I went, "Excuse me, Mr. Gray?"
And then they reply, well, yes, like slaves. Because, as we all know, marriage is an awful thing that no one wants to actually ever do.
50 Shades of Philbrick.
Look, marriage between the morons and the hot chicks can't be a good thing. Reproduction between the morons and the hot chicks can't be a hot thing. I mean, look, if my plan had worked and Roman had come out of the cave and just shot all of the guys, it would have helped the gene pool of Earth. Come on.
This movie desperately needs a good alien mother-in-law joke.
I'm sure that's on the cutting room floor somewhere.
Well, but let's not forget, they did say that's why these girls are good, because they can't go home to mother. Ha! You know, that's what chicks do when you're dealing with dames and broads.
Oh, and don't get me started on the end where everybody walks out free as a bird, walks out of the cave, and Philbrick and Penn walk out of the cave, and then the girls come out with all the stuff.
All the equipment, yes.
Hilarious.
All the stuff. Because you know what?
Apparently they...
Like slaves.
Yeah, like slaves. Uh-huh. They have decided that, yes, they want to be slaves, but they won't do anal.
Damn!
No, it's right out of the contract. They negotiated that right out.
Well, I wasn't expecting that. Well, we took a hard left turn there.
Yeah.
Oh, well. You'd understand.
Okay, so great. That frees me up to do my salad tossing joke.
Okay. Go on.
I won't. But that's one of the things, that's one of those jokes that makes you wonder in retrospect, was that a sexual politics term? There's a reference to having a veggie man toss your salad.
Oh, stop.
And back then, I wonder, was that a term back in the 60s? How in-jokey, how racy is this movie?
Oh, look, I don't think that was a term until Oprah told us it was a term.
Okay.
It is always weird when you're watching something from the 1950s or 1960s or 1970s, and somebody says a thing, and you're like, did that mean what I think that means?
So
it may not, but yes. You don't know.
So the closing scene of this film is a grand assemblage of stock footage. I mean, soldiers. and Philbrick and Penn get their commendation. And where was that closing scene shot? Because it looked like it was shot in somebody's front yard.
Huh.
I thought it was shot in a public park.
Might have been.
More than likely.
Might have just been doing some guerrilla filming. Likely.
And they go off into the sunset with Tanga and Puna. And what's the closing credit? It's the end, babe. It's the end, daddy, is it?
Was it?
Yeah, I think so.
I my brain might have been fried by that point.
I think it's the end.
Yeah. So,
which and when I saw that credit, all I did was go, thank God.
Your heart lifted a little.
Yes, my heart grew three sizes that moment.
Oh, thank God it's over.
To go little big man on you, my heart soars like an eagle. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, anything, any other observations anybody wants to make?
Well, I think I know the origin of bad SNL sketches that get turned into movies. This is the secret origin of that.
We didn't really talk about the music at all.
There was music?
You want to talk about the music? Well, I mean, after the drilling stops, yes, there was some
Justin, I mean,
music.
You know, well, for one thing, you know, it's true that, you know, in the credits it's referred to as electronic noise, mm-hmm. not music, which may be more fitting. There are actually people involved with that, a guy named Elliot Fisher and Jack Cookerley, and I think Elliot Fisher is a pseudonym, yeah, for a guy named William Luce. But, you know, it does seem like, you know, they put their heart into their work. The music did demonstrate, I think, all the dedication of a skating rink organist. You know, that sort of like the hands are doing the work while the mind is working on how to get into the pants of the girl who runs the concession stand. That's pretty much the level it was at.
And public domain stuff, too. They end with Colonel Bogey, the Bridge of the River Kwai, yeah, whistling soon.
Yeah.
So, whatever they can grab.
So two people had to work on that music, by the way.
You mean one to hold the electric drill and the other one to plug it into the wall?
Yes.
Someone had to record it, too.
Mm. Oh, there you
go. It's a union job.
So, anything anybody else wants to say, or shall we go into what we learned from this movie?
Let's do what we learned.
Okay. So, Andrea, you start us off.
If you don't have the money for music for your opening credits, just use an electric drill instead.
Kevin?
I learned that lighters can be used for more than just lighting cigars. You can use them like a compass.
Hawk?
You can actually construct something from the rare element unfunny.
Sergeants are way out, man. You dig?
The heights of people relative to each other can vary widely from scene to scene.
In space, nobody can hear you struggle to get into your two-piece.
Kissing space babes short circuits their brain.
Picking a man up by his collar looks a lot like him. Look, excuse me, let me start that again. Picking a man up by his collar looks a lot like him stepping on top of an apple box.
Cute. Actually, I'm out.
Oh, wow.
I got one more.
Okay.
Today's Army can prepare you for an excellent career as a civilian.
Nice.
Hawk?
Join today's Army and get kidnapped by alien space babes. And I have no idea at that point.
Oh, I guess I got, hey, I can toss one more. The corollary to that, Army, an excellent place to meet your spouse.
As long as they're slaves.
Alien spaceship control panels prove they have mastered the advanced technology of stenciling. Anybody else?
I am out.
Kevin? Okay, I've got a few more.
Dan learned a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, I work at it.
I totally forgot we had to do this part of it, making it up on the fly. For 8 months!
The sets aren't so much geodesic domes as geodesic dumb. I think I know where John Hodgman got the idea for his mustache.
Oh, shit.
Nice.
Wow.
And finally, I sincerely want to apologize to all Native Americans everywhere. Smallpox-laced blankets, army massacres being forced onto reservations. You didn't deserve this.
Yeah. Yikes. So,
shall we move on to the drinking game?
Oh,
yes.
That part I remember.
Yeah.
That I've got. Okay. Oh, believe me. That I've got.
Okay. Andrea, start us off.
Take a drink every time you notice a sloppy editing cut.
Oh, jeez. Take a drink every time somebody puts on a gas mask.
Ooh. Every time a special effect is just someone flailing about, take a drink.
Take a drink every time the background music tries to convince you that something that isn't at all funny is actually hilarious.
All right, guys, get ready to cross one off your list. Mm-hmm. Take a drink every time you see the characters do that Scooby-Doo thing of running back and forth stage right and stage left.
Ah, damn.
Yeah. Oh, this is so meta. Take a drink every time someone says drunk.
Ooh.
That's good.
Take a drink every time someone mentions Space Commander Connors.
Oh, there you go.
Take a drink every time it's obvious a prop or a set was made out of rice paper or aluminum foil.
Take a drink every time you see someone looking directly into the camera.
I miss that.
The fourth wall. There's a couple of breaks of the fourth wall.
Crossing. Yep.
Every time someone lights a cigar, take a drink.
Oh, look at you.
Every time they make a joke and you don't laugh or even feel like laughing, take a drink. No, don't take a drink.
Yeah, yeah.
Just empty the entire bar. Yeah. Just pour every piece of liquor down your throat. Just do it.
Take a drink every time somebody does something he clearly just thought of 5 minutes before the cameras rolled. Take three drinks if you suspect he didn't warn the director first.
Take a drink every time you see that they undercranked the film for, quote, comedic effect, unquote.
Every time Penn does a celebrity impression, take a drink. Take two if you recognize the celebrity.
That's one off my list. But every time Sergeant Glory speaks like a Hepcat man, take a drink, Daddy-O.
Oh, damn it. That's off my list now. Okay.
Take a drink every time a close-up is too damn close. I swear I could smell the breath of the actors in some of those things. By the way, take three drinks if the close-up is of one of the two handsome actors.
Oh. Okay, then I have one left, which is take a drink every time someone says something that's insensitive to women, Native Americans, or any other group of people.
My last one. Maybe it's just me, but take a drink every time there seems to be a shot of the girl's rear ends.
Oh, my God.
No, they were definitely going the Ralph Bakshi route in this film.
Take a drink every time the alien babes speak in that weird alien language, which just seems to be some record scratching rather than some actual language.
Okay. My final one. Take a drink every time you think, you know, maybe we do have to return some land to its original owners. Anybody else?
Oh, I'm out.
Kevin?
I'm out.
Nope.
Okay, that's it then. So, before we go, that wraps up Invasion of the Star Creatures, first thing. And Hawk, I guess it's your turn now to pick a film. So what are we going to do next time around?
Well, I don't know yet. But it will be evil.
Oh.
Evil.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
I'm impressed. So,
insert maniacal laughter here.
Yes. So let's bring people up to date. Andrea, I understand BeABetterBookTalker.com had some problems recently.
Yes, Be A Better BookTalker still exists in the hypothetical plane, but it is on a technical hiatus because my site got hacked. So, as of this moment, I can't upload, you know, images or MP3s or any of, like, the good stuff. So the site is still there, and the book talks are still there in text form. But, yes, I am working with the security computer security people and the GoDaddy people and figuring out if I will be able to repair what's there and sort of rebuild from here on, or if it is so screwed up that I am going to have to restart and restart my 3 years worth of work from scratch.
Which
would suck.
Which sort of explains why the last podcast of yours I heard seemed to sound like some hostile guy going, "Tell your kids about Koran."
Nice. Yes. Anyway, technical hiatus, but it will be rebuilt in one form or another.
Kevin, what's going on with your website?
You can go to kevinlauderdale.livejournal.com and see the stuff I have to plug. Woo, hoo, I have stuff to plug. Number one, if you enjoy young adult novels, or you have a smart young adult in your life who'd like to give them a novel that has no vampires, no zombies, and no werewolves, but is about smart teenagers doing smart things, my buddy Jeff Ayers and I have indie published a little novel called The Fourth Lion, F-O-U-R-T-H, Lion. You can pick this up in dead tree format or electronic format at Amazon.com. It is about a couple of smart teenagers in the D.C. area, contemporary setting, who decide to take it upon themselves to solve the mystery of a friend's disappearance. They use cutting-edge social media and good old-fashioned gumshoe detecting to do about this. They're a brother and sister who do not bicker constantly, yet another cliche we're all tired of. And it got some pretty decent reviews. My buddy Jeff and I are quite proud of it. And if you like history, you can pick up a brand new anthology called And All Our Yesterdays, edited by Andrew McCrae, M-A-C-R-A-E. It's filled with action, adventure, and mystery stories set across the world in different times and places. My story is based on a historical fact about a young Abraham Lincoln who took a little trip down the Mississippi delivering some goods and encountered various adventures. And if you're a Star Trek original series fan, you can see a little Easter egg that's hidden in there.
And I will throw in an additional plug for The Fourth Lion, which I did read and I enjoyed. And that's coming from me as a young adult librarian in real life. And I will also say that if you know Kevin, then you will know that he's a fan of Sherlock Holmes. And you will not be disappointed because, yes, there are Sherlock Holmes references in the book.
And Star Trek references and Doctor Who references. It is a very geek-centric contemporary adventure.
Woohoo!
It sounds nice. So, Hawk, what's doing with you?
Well, I'm still blogging at multimediumrare.com. That's multimediumrare.com. And I'm actually starting to write a few more things about pop culture again. But lately, most of what I've been writing has been, again, as everybody knows, I've been writing my journey as I recover from widowhood, which I shouldn't say recover from widowhood, as I journey through widowhood. And I have been talking a lot about dating lately as a widower. And dating in your 40s is weird. And, yeah, that's all I've been talking about, how weird it is. Yes, it's strange.
Is it as strange as Invasion of the Star Creatures?
Oh, come on.
Just
few things.
Actually, it's stranger.
What? What?
Yow.
That's a story that I can't share with the rest of the world. That'll be with just you guys. So I'll tell you about that after.
Okay. Okay. So, and let me just say that if you are in the tri-state New York area, you can hear my movie reviews on Hour of the Wolf every Thursday morning or Wednesday night, however you like to look at it. I like to look at it as Thursday morning at 1:30 a.m. at WBAI 99.5 FM. You can also hear it streaming over at WBAI.org. Or if you're not a night owl, you can listen to the archive show also by going to WBAI.org. And that'll be it for the show. So, Andrea Lipinski, thank you for joining us.
I am delighted to be here, and we promise that we won't be gone for such a long time again.
Okay. And Kevin Lauderdale, thank you.
Vita Meat of Veggie Men. They're so tasty, too.
Wow.
Wow. And Arenthal Hawkins, the ball's in your court now. You've got to deliver up the goods.
Oh, namaste. The star creature in me salutes the star creature in you.
Wow.
And I'm Dan Persons. Thank you, everyone, for listening. The music is by Brad Sucks at bradsucks.net. This show is copyright 2015 Upstart Company NYC. I am Dan Persons, your host and producer, saying until next time, may a bad film be the worst thing to happen to you. It's the same.